Esther 4, verses 4 through 6. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. So Hatak went forth to Mordecai unto the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. The beginning of the chapter, we are made to understand that Mordecai, being a spiritual man, holding the true faith, perceives all that was done when Haman sent out letters into all the provinces calling for the destruction of all the Jews throughout the whole of the Persian Empire. We're told that Mordecai perceived all that was done because he understood not only what had transpired outwardly, but what was transpiring at least to some degree inwardly, because he understood the psychology of men, particularly sinful men. He understood not only what was going on horizontally, that is, among the society and community of men, but vertically between the community or society of men and God. He grasped not only the physical and historical dimensions of the challenge now that was before the Jewish people, but most importantly, Mordecai, because he is a spiritual man, because he's a prophet of God, as we are made to understand from the rabbis, Mordecai knows that the causes of God's wrath against his people are due to their sins. He knows, in fact, that none of these horrible events would be taking place if God was not angry with his people. Israel's history, scattered amongst the Persian Empire, was one of degradation and assimilation at many different levels. In chapter 1 of Esther, we saw reasons to believe that many of the Jews had engaged themselves in that lengthy, drunken feast or festival that the heathen kingdom was partaking of sometime earlier in the reign of Ahasuerus. Their identity as Jews, the people of God, had been obscured to some degree, although they, like so many ethnic minorities, were still seen to be outsiders and recognizably different from other peoples in the vast empire. So the Jews probably thought, you don't really notice we're here. And they're trying to trim being Jewish just enough to feel like they really fit in. And among themselves, they probably perceive themselves as being pretty well compatible and fitting in with the Persian Empire. But to those who are not Jews, if you were a Jew, you probably still stuck out like a sore thumb to them. The problem is this. The Jews had been, throughout this time of the diaspora in the Persian Empire, they'd been trying to have it both ways. They wanted one foot in this world, represented by the Persian Empire, and the other foot in heaven, represented by the nation of Israel. And that very often is the case that we find in the Church of God. So what they had done is they'd compromised their witness toward the world. And they had compromised themselves before God. You know, it's funny because when Christians are out in the world, you know, to a certain extent, for a little while, you might think that that you've assimilated. And other people might not perceive something until you get to some point where you're just not going to participate in whatever it is they're doing, and then you stick out like a sore thumb. But the fact that you go that far without being detected probably is telling you you've already compromised quite a bit. The fact is that their course of conduct now had provoked the highest and invited judgments to fall upon them as a people. Their sin or sins had broken down the hedge that we know God sets around those that are his elect people. They had broken through, they'd broken down that hedge, and they'd allowed a serpent to break through. Now this serpent, or seed of the serpent, Haman, was advanced to high places of power and trust, and now he had commanded their destruction, and had done so with the consent of the king. Now, realizing this, Mordecai tears his clothes and puts on sackcloth and ashes. In doing so, he signifies his own recognition of the root of the calamity now facing the Jewish people. Remember, I said sackcloth, rough clothing, hair cloth. Not only does that remind us of some of the prophets in the Bible, such as John the Baptist or Elijah, but he takes it upon himself, as those prophets did, to remind himself of his sinful estate. You have to remember, clothing, so far from being proper symbols of pride, clothing has become necessary because of man's fall into sin. So clothes are, as one Puritan has so aptly noted, bandages to cover our depravity. Why would you want to take pride in your bandages? There's something wholly distorted when we want to turn the symbol of our disgrace before God into something in which we're going to boast. So there's always been something of a suspicion that true believers have had when it comes to the fashions of the world. By exchanging comfortable clothing for something designed to rub uncomfortably against his flesh, Mordecai shows us that he is connecting the impending genocide of the Jewish nation to deeds of the sinful flesh. He's made this connection, and he wants to be in constant reminder of this. And then he adds ashes, demonstrating he understands that the wages of sin is death. As we heard when God first decreed in the garden, from dust man is taken, and unto dust he shall return. And that's all because of sin. Mordecai, however, doesn't stop there. He not only has gone out of his way to dress down, to dress in a manner that will call attention to himself, certainly, but not in a particularly positive way. He doesn't stop with just sackcloth and ashes. Because it's not his sin particularly. It's rather the sins of the nation that have brought the Jews to this terrible crossroads now. And so he moves to make his penitence public. The reason is, he has been all along a public man. He is, as I've said, a prophet amongst these exiled people. And now he uses his status as such as a platform to sound abroad a message. A message both of the countdown to judgment, but also of the need for the Jews to repent. And so he cried with a loud and bitter cry, as one lamenting deeply over the terrible emerging situation. This is the kind of howl or cry that went up, for example, when David and his men come back to Ziklag and realize that their wives and their children have all been taken captive, and they don't know where to find them. They don't even know whether or not they're alive. It's the kind of cry and soul moan that recognizes that the situation before the Jewish people is one of existential, it's an existential crisis. This public display of his own repentance, then, together with the implication that there was a sinful cause for which God was abandoning them to their enemies, that's a message that Mordecai, given his position, was intent on carrying to the Jews throughout the kingdom as best he could. Now, it's the duty of all of God's people to decry the sins of their society. But it is especially the duty of those who would occupy a prophetic role towards society to do so. And it's for this very reason that we see here that covenanters historically have been testimony or witness bearers. Covenanters are constrained to go forth from the societies in which they find themselves in order to testify Christ's word of patience to a resistant, obstinate, sinful, wicked generation. In Revelation 19:10, John says, "I fell at his feet," that is, the feet of an angel, "to worship him. And the angel said unto me, See thou do it not, I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus, worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." Testifying, witness bearing, is in fact carrying the spirit of prophecy. It is showing continuity with what Mordecai is doing here. And that's why this has been an important doctrine amongst covenanters, that we would show forth the same spirit and the same commitment to the same truth, that is, the testimony of Jesus, that we should worship God, the true God. So Mordecai is making this message public. And that's why Mordecai made it a point to go before the king's gate. Because that was a place where he was sure his message would be relayed to all points throughout the kingdom. Eventually, whatever's going on at the gates of the kingdom, or the palace, will make it out. It will trickle out into the rest of the kingdom, the empire. Everybody's going to find out what's going there. It's just like in this country. Whatever goes on in Washington, D.C., we eventually find out about that, don't we? You know, when a gunman is at the gates of the White House, we hear about that. We don't usually hear about them when they're somewhere else unless they actually kill a bunch of people. But you just have to show up with a gun there and you're found out. It's the same idea, the same thing here. He's going there because he knows he's going to get out. But most importantly, what Mordecai wants is this. He wants to make sure that this message is brought before the queen. Now, the unusualness of Mordecai even approaching the king's gate when he's dressed in this fashion is noted in our text. He's not even allowed to enter the gate when he's clothed like this. So his presence is going to be something of note to those who are guarding the gate. Because the first thing they have to do is take note of this guy. They can't let him through. Now he's going to stand there. And everybody who's let through and everyone else who's not let through Everyone who's coming out of the gate is going to see him standing there. This is certainly then going to draw attention both to the action and the actor. And we can see then Mordecai, although these are religious actions, which are also calculated to garner at least some political response in the Persian Empire. And finally, we've seen that Mordecai's lead was followed throughout the kingdom as the proclamation was read. Because we were told in the first couple of verses in this chapter, the Jews everywhere, when they hear the commandment and the decree of the king, that they too begin to act like Mordecai. They put on sackcloth and ashes, and they begin to fast. We're told, with respect to the Jews throughout the kingdom, that with the donning of the sackcloth and ashes, they begin fasting as well. So they're in this, they're demonstrating that they're taking this as a religious challenge, a spiritual challenge. They're taking it seriously. Now, in all of this, although God is never mentioned in the book of Esther, we are constrained to see here that the people of God still understand themselves to be debtors of grace and servants of the Most High. That's how they perceive themselves, or they wouldn't behave that way. Their fasting is unto the Lord, even though his name is not present. Moreover, they, like Mordecai, we have every reason to believe, saw not merely the hand of Haman set against them, but the hand of God for their sins. After all, they, by this time, had probably heard the prophet Isaiah say, as we read in Isaiah 54:16, "Behold, I've created the smith that bloweth the coals and the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy." Haman is a waster. And God is telling his people in captivity under Isaiah, "I have created the waster to destroy." If you come to know Haman, that he's a waster of the people of God, you must also know that God has set him there to destroy you. And he's done it because of your sin. This is a conclusion that every pious Jew is going to reach as word reaches them. So beginning now with verse 4. "So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. The house of women where the queen was kept was secluded from the news of the kingdom in all likelihood. In fact, it appears that they had not heard so much of the decree gone forth against the Jews." Now, this is implied early on in the chapter, but it becomes patently clear later in this chapter, as we'll see. The reason is that these affairs would have been considered amongst the province of men, not women. And after all, this killing of a bunch of Jews throughout the empire, that's dirty business. And it probably wouldn't have been very appropriate even to mention it before the queen. In fact, outside of certain situations, the king himself probably didn't want to know about it or hear about it anymore. But the fact is that women were at this time truly domestics. They were homebodies. And they generally had no need, especially amongst the ranks of royalty, for this kind of knowledge. It just didn't suit their place and station in life. And yet now, there is a spectacle set before the gate of the king. Right? Mordecai was wandering about in sackcloth and ashes, and he's crying with a loud and bitter cry. So you can't ignore this fellow, because he's not just an eyesore, he's an earsore to all who are at the gate. I want you to notice here that the maids and chamberlains, really, chamberlains is referring to eunuchs. That's a nice way of referring to eunuchs, but the Hebrew word means they're eunuchs. They're described as belonging to Esther here. And the reason is they were her peculiar charge. Now, I'm going to modify what I just said in just a minute, but we need to keep that in mind first, I think. So most likely the maids would have remained within the house of the women with her. And any time there needed to be any intercourse between the house of the women and everyone else, the eunuchs would have carried information, necessary supplies, etc., from outside, inside, or taking things from inside, outside, as need be. All right. In addition to that, the eunuchs would have been charged with guarding the house of the women. So the house of the women was very much secluded. And while they belonged to Esther, they belonged to Esther because, ultimately, as we'll see, all of them belong to the king. And he wants to make sure that his women remain his women alone. Right, we have to remember this is a time under an Eastern despot. And this is a kind of absolute rule. You know, so when people want to criticize the place that women have in Christianity, they need to consider the place that women had before Christianity was ever published on the face of the earth. It was, in fact, very restrictive and often very brutal. It seems that the news of Mordecai before the gate had come to Esther through a combination of both the maids and the chamberlains. It's been suggested, and I think not improbably, if we understand a little bit about how these two groups of people would function, that the maidens had perhaps noticed when Mordecai was no longer seated within the court of the king in his usual place, because they would have been hanging around within the king's gate. And from time to time, if they left the king's or the women's house, they would have been in this area controlled by the king and all of his officers and all of his underlings. They would have noticed, and this is likely how Esther and Mordecai are communicating at this time, they would have been able to carry messages back and forth between Mordecai and Esther without compromising the knowledge that Esther was a Jew, which is something that no one at this point really knows, other than Mordecai, who brought her up. Now, because they were aware and likely involved with communications that Mordecai had maintained with Esther in her seclusion, his absence would have been something they would have had to report almost immediately to the queen. Now, once his absence from within the court is noted, it remains for the eunuchs then to bring her news of Mordecai now standing before the king's gate in his strange manner of dress, because they would have been the ones who would have been in a position to go further outside of the house of women. So after all, unlike the maidens, the eunuchs are not actually living, for the most part, with the women. Some may have the guards, but for the most part, not so much. They're sort of in a middling position. Now, the dress and the fashion that Mordecai had done is so contrary to the manner of the Persians that the eunuchs who were numbered among the courtiers that were found regularly in the inner court of the king, they would have considered that whole spectacle with a degree of astonishment. So you can't have a guy standing out there without the eunuchs taking note. The chamberlains are all going to take note. It's going to be a topic of conversation among them. You know, did you see that guy? It's just a natural reaction among people when you see something that unusual to your culture. Did you see that? Now, we have to remember, it's Mordecai's attire was the very reason he couldn't pass into the king's gate. And so the eunuchs are going to know that. And when Esther or another of her maids then inquires concerning the absence of Mordecai, one or several of these eunuchs certainly are going to have an answer. Chamberlains are going to know what's going on. They're going to know that he's no longer in the gate. Now he's that guy, that weird guy standing outside the gate in sackcloth and ashes, crying, lamenting. I want you to note that despite her advancement, one might argue, in fact, because of her advancement, that Esther has actually, from what we can gather here, become a sort of prisoner in her own house. But she's attended by maids and chamberlains whose sole purpose is to do her bidding. But at the same time, she is cut off from all of her personal enjoyments, especially when it came to that company that she enjoyed with Mordecai, who had brought her up from a child. Now, we have to keep in mind that the reason Esther is even here is this. She has undertaken to live in this condition because she was asked to do so in a roundabout way, but she was still being asked to do so by Mordecai himself. And Mordecai was asking her because he, as a prophet of God, knew that her placement in the palace would become crucial to the success of the Jewish people in the future. So Esther enters into this gilded prison with a much higher end in view than simply becoming queen. Right? There are a lot of women who might have been happy to be the queen of the Persian Empire. That wasn't really Esther's motive here. I think in this, she shows us something of Christ in his condescension to take upon himself our nature in order to bring about our redemption. And yet, I also think there's this very interesting contrast, because Christ comes down to be imprisoned in our flesh. He leaves his rich estate to be imprisoned in our poverty. Whereas Esther is actually going to be elevated from a state of poverty to be imprisoned in a palace. But again, in both cases, it's in order to bring about the redemption of the people of God. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved. And here we're reminded of Esther's status within the kingdom. She's called queen here. And calling her queen, what the author of the book is doing is bringing to our attention her relation to the king. And that's a kind of providential foreshadowing that's being highlighted here. Because Esther, in obedience to Mordecai, her elder cousin and surrogate father, she'd entered the contest to become the wife of the king, and she was now, because of all of this, positioned as queen to lend some aid to the distressed condition of the Jews, which we're going to see later in this chapter and in the following chapters. Now, it's in light of her royal status that we're told that this news about Mordecai was very grievous to Esther, not simply personally. There is a personal dimension here, but as queen. So she perceives something deeper in Mordecai's actions than was probably related by the maids and the eunuchs. She'd been raised up by him. Remember that. He had raised her from a small girl. Undoubtedly, he had taught her the principles of the true religion. And so she understood the significance of sackcloth and ashes. And she also would have been familiar with the attendant fasting, although she may not yet have known that he was fasting. She probably could have assumed that. But here was not only distress, but this was a distress meant to be understood to be deeply religious or spiritual. And she is going to understand that. She doesn't need to be told anything else. She was raised in the same house together with Mordecai. She knows something about how he thinks. She knows something about how true religion works and all of that. Now, the Hebrew here indicates that the grief expressed by the queen is perhaps a little bit more than you might conclude if you just read that she was exceedingly grieved. It actually states the queen was very much afflicted, but the word used describes a kind of grief that comes upon a woman in childbirth. And although she doesn't yet know the story behind Mordecai's strange appearance, the fact is she immediately greets the news of his manner of dress and behavior with a marked sense of foreboding. She knows something is wrong, deeply wrong. There's a certain alliteration in the Hebrew word which serves to emphasize the fear that struck her. There's a guttural repetition. The word is tithchalchal. It's almost like a death rattle in the throat. And the rabbis actually talk about that a little bit. They understand that there was that kind of restriction. You know, when your throat, you become fearful and your throat gets dry and feels like it's constricted. She knew for the moment nothing of the trouble of the whole nation of the Jews. But her appearance, or his appearance, I should say, Mordecai's appearance, must have suggested to her that some close relative or some close friend had died. Nevertheless, she would certainly also have known that the Persians would have regarded such mourners, people dressed like Mordecai, going about like that, as unclean. In Persian culture, what Mordecai was doing was considered unclean, ceremonially unclean. And that explains then her actions, which we're told follow. Okay? So she's exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai. She does this, in all likelihood, because the Persians had a custom of sending new clothing to near relations of those who were mourning for the dead. In fact, because she had been brought up in this somewhat assimilated culture, she probably looked upon this as a matter of filial duty to provide new raiment for a mourner. When he died in Persian culture, it was the obligation of those around you to take care of the body and to guide the soul. And part of it involved having someone wearing new garments around the body from time to time and even into the future on anniversaries of the death of the person. Now, the fact that she jumped to this conclusion shows she may not have been kept from buying into some of the Persian religious customs, even though she had been raised by Mordecai. Or perhaps she's simply eager to remove any impediments so that she can speak directly to Mordecai in the inner court. Because she knows as long as he's dressed that way, he cannot come before her. He can't get inside, and it's going to make it much harder for her to have access to him to find out what is going on. Therefore, we're also told she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him. Because as I said, as long as he remained clothed in sackcloth, he can't enter the king's gate. This new raiment, then, that would have removed the obstacle placed between them by the garments of mourning. She needs that to be gone. Now here, I think we need to pause and actually wonder at the great love that Esther has for Mordecai, very clearly. Remember, he had strictly commanded her not to make known her Jewish lineage. Don't tell anyone that you're a Jew or Jewess. However, now she had sent him garments to replace his mourning clothes. And to all of those around her, to those who were raised in Persian culture, this is a giveaway if they thought about it much. So she'd undoubtedly revealed more than was safe given the developing political terror on the horizon. Because her maids and the eunuchs, the chamberlains, they must have realized, or they should have realized as soon as she did it, that sending new raiment suggested that Esther was somehow related to Mordecai. Now, they know this, and presumably they also would know that Mordecai was a Jew, and if they really thought about it and connected the dots, they would realize if Esther is related to Mordecai and Mordecai is a Jew, then Esther too must be a Jew. And yet somehow we see here another providence, because her identity, though it would be open for those, particularly in her entourage, to see exactly who she is and what she is, her identity still manages to remain concealed, providentially. And the reason is, the time for the revelation that she's a Jewess had not yet come. Now, I bring that up just to remind you that the book of Esther, as I've said several times, we've been going through it, is a grand miracle, one great miracle, masquerading as a series of small coincidences. Right? Too many coincidences going on here for this not to demonstrate the superintending hand of divine providence. You know, everything just happens to fall out right, even when Esther, out of love, impulsively reaches out and tries to get Mordecai's attention and get him before her. So he sent raiment to clothe Mordecai, to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Mordecai didn't receive them because he was not mourning for a dead person, but rather for a nation facing extermination. He refused the gift of the queen, which may have actually confused the maids and chamberlains. Well, we're not really sure, but we know he remains silent. His actions are left without comment. There's no comment here. Now, clearly, Mordecai wished to have a word with Esther. That's why he went to the gate. But you see, he's not going to do anything that would reveal her identity before the proper time. Now, in this, we can see Mordecai's discernment and wisdom as he moves to bring this plot against the Jews to an end. Now, in Esther's action, what do we see? We see the impulse of unfeigned love, which was willing to risk exposing herself to danger, along with Mordecai, before the proper time. But in Mordecai's response, we see that love is not enough. Love must be guided by wisdom, or it can prove to be fatal. Additionally, by sending back the garments, Mordecai dismisses her fear that some close relative or friend has died. And in doing so, I think he's intimating that something much more sinister is actually brewing. The reason for mourning, in other words, he's indicating, is not necessarily past someone who's already died, but it now lay ahead. Furthermore, it didn't embrace one relative only or one friend only, but potentially now it's going to embrace all of Esther's kindred scattered throughout the whole of the Persian Empire. Now, why would she come to that conclusion from this? Because when he sent these garments back, it now becomes clear to her that this sorrow, this mourning that he's displaying, is not personal, but public sorrow. And Esther now needs to know what's going on. And so in verse 5, then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. Then called Esther for Hatak. Esther is now faced with a couple of serious questions. Number one, why is Mordecai in mourning? She now knows it's not personal but public. And she also is going to have reason to be concerned for her kindred. She's maybe not sure how broad the concern should be yet. But she understands that this is something that's affecting the Jewish people. She also has to wonder why Mordecai is not going to put off the sackcloth and ashes and approach to speak with her. Why won't he do that? And so with these questions before her, Esther decides she's going to take action. She calls. More properly, in this place, it's better, I think, to understand call, the Hebrew word here, as summoning. Okay, she's... And I say that because these maids and chamberlains belong to her. They're there to do her bidding. And she summons one named Hatak. Now the Jews, the rabbis, they gabble over this name. And they assert that this name, Hatak, was actually another name for Daniel. They actually think that Daniel is going to carry the message to Mordecai. At least some of them do. There's no reason to think that at all. You know, beside the fact that, Daniel's involved in a different situation altogether in the empire. There's just no reason to think that that's what's going on. In fact, it's been rightly noted, I believe, that making him a secret Jew would have placed someone near her that would most likely have already heard about the plight of the Jewish people in the empire. Okay, someone of that kind of status or stature. Now, it's not that the news had trickled in yet to the palace, because we know that from what we see later. It appears that the Jews in the palace hadn't gotten word yet as to what was happening. They don't until Mordecai tells them. But someone of Daniel's status... And if we read in the book of Daniel his status before the king, we would think, would have been privy to that knowledge, and it would have been conveyed if he were the one. Instead, I think it's better to understand the name Hatak probably connotes that he's a courier. And it's maybe not a proper name. It may not even be his actual name. It might simply be a title belonging to a particular eunuch. He's the courier. All right? He's the Hatak. Now, the name Hatak also means verity. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. And then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains. Ultimately, everything in the Persian kingdom, as I said before, belonged to the king, even those who waited upon the queen. They were her property at the king's pleasure. And that's an important thing to keep in mind here. So in this phrase, and I don't think that this is as anything in the Bible, I think every word is there to give us something to sort of mull over, something to think about. So by this phrase, I think we're being reminded of the complete despotism that sat over the realm of Persia. That's one thing anyway. Nevertheless, this reality only serves to make plain the sovereignty of God in life. Remember what Solomon said in Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. So, to the eyes of flesh, to unbelievers, or to just to the eyes of the flesh, if you're only looking to the outward, all things are under the iron grip of an arbitrary military dictator named Ahasuerus, who's ruling over the kingdom of Persia. Nothing escapes his command or control. But as our eyes are brought to think upon this, we have to remember this secret providence going on in the book of Esther all the time. And so our faith should be redirected to consider the guiding hand of the Lord in all things. As we see providence after providence in the book of Esther, moving all of the pieces into place for the redemption of the Jews. One seemingly insignificant thing after another. And then called Esther for Hadad, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her. Haddock was appointed or set before the queen to attend upon her by the king. Now consider that. Unbeknownst to him, his very appointment is going to be turned to serve the interests of the people of God. In fact, this very appointment of an insignificant eunuch is going to be used ultimately to overturn his appointing of the use of his signet ring on Haman's decree to destroy the Jews. It's no mistake, by the way, that Esther chose one of her eunuchs for this task. Eunuchs were actually known to be extremely loyal to the women that they served. And so, evidently, she had supreme confidence that she could trust him with the task that she has designed for him. So she called for Hadad, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed upon to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai. Now, I want you to think about that language right there in that clause. Esther speaks very strictly with her eunuch, giving him a commandment, not so much for himself, but for Mordecai. In other words, Esther is telling Hadad to command Mordecai on her behalf. She's now gripped by an increasing concern and an increasing fear. She's feeling those labor pains of a woman in travail. And Mordecai's rebuff of the new garments has not lessened her sense of anxiety here, but likely augmented it. And it certainly increased her reason for concern. She needed to know, and she had no way of knowing, apart from Mordecai, what it is that was happening. Why the spectacle? So for this reason, she's pressing Hadad to command Mordecai regarding this. So she gave him a command to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. There are two distinct questions. Esther wishes to know what the calamity was, which either had befallen the people of God or was going to befall the people of God. But she also wants to know the cause of that calamity. Now, as to the first, what it was, she still had no clue. You would think news this big, it's already, from what we've read in Esther, it's already reaching the outermost edges of the kingdom. And somehow, she still hasn't heard. And she's in the very palace where the decree was made. But her seclusion in the House of Women had left her cut off from such matters as I indicated earlier. It was something public, however, and it involved the whole of her kindred. This much, at least, I think by now she could surmise. However, Haman's decree, his commanded decree, his letters, though they had reached every corner of the empire outside the palace, as I say, they hadn't yet come within. Now, that may seem bizarre. But I think that maybe what we should understand is that no one suspected that there were any high-ranking Jews in the royal house, especially not the queen. And so, again, there would be no need to sully the general atmosphere in the inner court with these kinds of dirty matters of actual governing an empire as a despot. You know, brutality was something the Persian Empire did well. They served it up well. They did it every day. And so killing, you know, a few thousand or tens of thousands of Jews, or maybe hundreds of thousands or even a million Jews, wouldn't really matter to them. Right? They did it well, and they had no need to dwell upon it. Everything outside served to prop up the king in his house. That's the whole empire exists really for this one palace. Why would you care? You know, hearing that a bunch of Jews are about to be cut off throughout the kingdom in order to keep your empire together. Well, that's like dwelling on the fact that, you know, you've got oil on the axle of your car. Right? You just don't want to do that. The car exists for you to get from point A to point B. And that's the way an Eastern despot is going to treat his empire. It exists for me. Everything exists for me. And why should I dwell on all the dirty stuff and all the nasty stuff all the time? No need. Now, as to the second question, why it was, the rabbis suggest that what Esther's actually eager to discover here is the sin that was procuring this calamity. If we understand Esther to have a good foundation in the true religion being raised by Mordecai, I think it does make some sense that she could be asking this. In fact, it makes a lot of sense, because she would know that what was befalling the Jews was a curse. And she would also know, as Scripture says, the curse causeless does not come. She would know, as the prophet says, that God does not afflict his people willingly, but by reason of their sins. And so Esther would have reason to conclude that there must be some sin or sins which provoked God's wrath upon his covenant people. These then were the things she charged Hadak, her eunuch courtier, to command Mordecai to tell her, so he could return with answers to the queen. So in verse 6. So Hadak went forth to Mordecai under the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. So Hadak went forth. That is, Hadak was able to leave the confines of the king's inner palace to accomplish this task for the queen. Here then is another reason for choosing a eunuch, and even this particular eunuch, known to her because he was her personal messenger. She wants someone trustworthy for the task at hand. Using her regular, who happens also to be very trustworthy, that allows what's about to happen to go undetected to some degree. Any other eunuch might have actually caused some suspicion as to his activity. The maids, they couldn't have gone forth too far. That would have excited some suspicion. And most of the eunuchs wouldn't have, at least not very often, would have ventured very far from the house of the women or where the queen was kept, because that would have posed a security risk to the queen. You just can't have people going out and in and guarding the queen all of the time. You need to have security, layer of security after layer of security here. After all, she's the one closest to the king. But the one designated her courier, and I think this is interesting why verity and courier, why these both can apply to this one, verity and truth. This one is vetted for going in and out, so the queen had some way of communicating with those outside of the house of the women and even outside of the inner court. He's already pre-approved, pre-screened to go out. So Haddock went forth to Mordecai. Note, he went out without pause. We see the loyalty of the chamberlain to his mistress here. She'd given orders, and he, we're told, was quick and faithful in carrying out those orders. She tells him, do this, and he does it. And of course, Mordecai, he's an easy one to spot in the crowd because of his appearance, and also because he's the guy who is crying with a loud and bitter cry, and he's attracting a lot of attention with that outfit he's wearing. So Haddock went forth to Mordecai onto the street of the city. Mordecai had remained in the open in the main street, which ran through the great capital city of the Persian Empire. And although he was there awaiting some response from Esther, he was also there because he didn't want to waste his time. He's there because this is a good place to continue to spread his message of repentance to anyone who would hear. Again, this is public mourning, and it was incumbent upon the Jews to join him in seeking God's face through prayer and fasting, and he's trying to get them to see that's what they need to do. So Haddock went forth to Mordecai into the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. We're reminded particularly that Mordecai had remained openly mourning before the king's gate, a place where it would attract the most attention and where it would raise the most questions. I want you to think one more time about the steadfastness of Mordecai. Because that's the character of one who really has the spirit of prophecy. It's the duty of a faithful witness to persevere until the end, come what may. Mordecai is not concerned about his own safety and well-being. He's concerned that the truth doesn't die out. Now, this attitude Mordecai has here, his carrying out of the duty of a faithful witness bearer, is something he did and he's going to continue to do, as we're going to see in subsequent verses. Now here, Haddock goes to meet with Mordecai, and in so doing, he demonstrates his faithfulness to Esther the queen. His action is encapsulated so succinctly in this verse that I think we're given a hint of his unswerving devotion to the queen. And that's not only in full view to us as we read that he's told to do this and he does it without hesitation. That unswerving devotion to the queen is also in full view for Mordecai. So Mordecai could assume from the eunuch's obedience that he commanded the confidence of Esther, and he would be right to perceive that. Again, we see Mordecai really does perceive all things that are going on. So Mordecai could from this conclude he could trust the queen's messenger and that this would make it easy for him to communicate everything he needed to communicate through this messenger. Now, our text is silent about what Haddock actually said to Mordecai. But Mordecai's response to Haddock in subsequent verses makes unmistakable that Esther's command had been tendered to Mordecai by her messenger. In this, we see he is deserving of the name Haddock or Verity, because in verity or in truth, he conveyed what he was supposed to convey. It doesn't even need to be repeated here, because we know that he commanded Mordecai exactly as Esther had told him to do. And in this meeting, we see also, I think, the empathy that passes between Mordecai and Esther, as well as her deep love and sympathy for him when she heard that he's out there mourning. Now, Esther must know of the problem if she's going to be useful to alleviate it. And I would suggest that, again, in this, she's reminding us of Christ, or at least of Christ's church. But Christ, the great physician who assumed our nature and infirmity that he might restore it to physical and spiritual health, he came that he might know. In order to effect cure, there needs to be a proper diagnosis, and Esther knows this. Esther must find out what is happening. What is happening to her people, when it's happening, why it's happening to her people. As I say, sending out an intermediary, Haddock, that could have presented a very real danger of compromising any communications between Esther and Mordecai. She must be able to trust him without question, because he's going to carry to her information, as we're going to see, that contains a very serious charge against a very high-ranking member of the king's most inner trusted court, Haman. And should Haddock prove to be less than absolutely reliable or absolutely trustworthy, she could find herself implicated in a plot to overthrow one of the king's favorites. And as we know from chapter 2, the king doesn't suffer what he considers to be treasonous activity to remain unpunished. There's a penalty for that, and the penalty is death. And Mordecai has, in this story, exhibited what we might consider courageous faith. He's waited at the gate, despite any danger to himself. He's waited until Esther has found a way to send her messenger out to him. And he will not yield until he knows that the counterplot, the divine counterplot, has been set to bring down wicked Haman and his plans for universal Jewish extermination. He's determined to show himself to be a faithful witness whose duty is to show Israel the path in the dark. And he alone is holding forth the light, saying the church must repent, and the magistrate must yield himself to be a nursing father to the church. In all, God must be glorified. So in Mordecai's words and actions are the footsteps in which the flock needs to go if they would find rest by the shepherd's tents. In conclusion, then, I want you to observe a couple of things. The seeming paradox of the position of the church in the world. And this is a theme throughout Scripture. The more difficult her situation in contrast to the world, the more favorable her position to show forth the glory of God. It's not when the church is at the height of her glory that in displaying the glory of God, that we see a lot said. In the Bible, we read about the church at the bottom a lot, because it's that transition from the bottom, from bondage to deliverance, that holds forth the truth of our redemption in Christ again and again. Now, in his low estate, Mordecai seeks to turn his distress and the distress of the Jewish people into a fulcrum of faith that's going to lift them out of their present danger. And at this point, whatever people might have known of Mordecai prior to this, like Moses before him, Mordecai now no longer can or will hide his identity as a Jew. But he's going to express it fully, and he does so before the king's gate. By faith, in other words, he's chosen rather to suffer with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. And in doing so, he's going to preside over the deliverance of the people of God on such a magnitude that it will invite comparison to Moses. It's no wonder then the Jewish people often speak of him and Moses in the same breath, and that they make Mordecai to be the second Moses. The faithful church, like Mordecai, will always bring upon her the wrath of the Hamans of the world. Remember that. Adhering to God's law through faith will always challenge the conventions of the world. It will excite the scorn, the resentment, and the opposition of the ungodly. And as the church from time to time grows in the power of grace, this opposition will rise until all comes to a head. For us, as we look forward to the coming of the millennium, that head is called Armageddon. Should we live to see that conflict rising, we shouldn't be alarmed. It's only the raging of the heathen against the government of the Son of God. Like Mordecai, we need to stand fast and be still and know that in due time, God shall deliver Zion from all of our enemies. Amen.